Welcome. I am Alihera Zazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Sunday, October 4th, is World Animal Day. On October 3rd and 4th, people in more than 100 cities around the globe will march to demand action to save elephants and rhinos. Here are some facts. Every 15 minutes, an elephant is killed for its ivory, meat, or body part. That's over 30,000 a year. A rhino is killed once every 8 hours for its horn. But today, we're going to only focus on elephants. Just 35 years ago, there were 1.3 million elephants in Africa. Today, that number is only at 300,000. And with the price of ivory now worth thousands of dollars, wildlife activists and conservationists say the elephant populations could be on their way to extinction if nothing is done to halt the global demand for both illegal and legal ivory market. Just last week, California Senate passed a bill that would effectively ban the sale of nearly all ivory in California. So what else is being done to protect these animals? Are these efforts enough? And should we be alarmed about the future of this magnificent mammals in the wild? Rose Alice is a member of the core organizing team for the Global March for Elephants and Rhinos, and she joins us in studio. Welcome back, Rosemary.
Thank you.
Really great to have you. I was just listening to our conversation from last year. Also in studio, we are joined by Julie Callahan. She is the March for Elephants spokesperson and co-founder of March for Elephants Santa Cruz. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Julie, really welcome back. And on the phone, we are joined by Professor George Wittemeyer. He is the scientific board chairman of Save the Elephants and assistant professor in the Department of Fish, Wildlife and Conservation Biology at Colorado State University. Professor Wittemeyer is the author of the 2014 groundbreaking report about the declining elephant populations in Africa. His research revealed that between 2010 and 2012, an estimated 100,000 elephants in Africa were killed for their ivory. Welcome back, Professor Wittemeyer.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And thank you so much for coming on the show on such a short notice. I just reached out to you, on Saturday?
Yeah.
Thank you so much, really.
Glad it could work out.
Really, very glad to have you on. So I just want to start by, whenever I read about elephants, I'm just inundated by figures and numbers. You know, the number of elephants being killed, poached, or hunted down, or used in circuses for a variety of reasons. I just want, if you can tell me how accurate these numbers are and how accurately can we really tell what is the state of the elephant populations. For example, it was estimated that around 7 to 10 million elephants existed in the 30s. Today, that number is at shocking 300,000. Elephant population numbers have dropped by 62% over the last decades, and they could be kind of distinct by the end of next decade. So can you put this in context for us?
Yeah, so it turns out it's, you know, they're the largest terrestrial mammal, but they're incredibly difficult to count. The elephants, because they're so large, they require very large ranges, and they're typically in relatively arid, low agricultural potential areas in Africa that are very vast, and so it's quite difficult to be able to cover them and accurately count them. And as they get poached or as they become under threat, they become more and more cryptic, so it's hard to see them. And it's particularly difficult to count them in the tropical forests of Central Africa, where it's very thick canopy, high-density vegetation, and you basically can't see them in there. Mm. So it's very hard to estimate their actual numbers. It's a real problem we've had in conservation, real effort. We put a lot of effort into it. But you'd be surprised at the number of species. We really have pretty poor guesses on how many are on the planet, just because they're not easy to count.
So how do you decide whether a species is on its way to extinction? Or, for example, there is this alarming rate of population decline, or if this is something that we have to just worry about. I mean, when we see 62% drop, that's quite a huge percentage in a population of any species, for that matter.
Right. Yes. So certainly with that sort of decline, that was actually numbers that came out of work we did for the forest elephants based off spore surveys. So looking for any sign of elephants and seeing how frequently and at what density we see their spore, the signs of them. And that's and so we use that as an indicator of their density. And so we found that these elephant spore were decreasing at that rate over the last decade, actually between 2001 and 2012. And so that's a good indication. When you're having that rapid of decline, you know you're you're having a serious problem with conservation.
Yeah.
We have a number of ways we assess risk status of species across the world. Some of them are based off actual numbers, actual counts, which we do in savanna elephants. We do aerial census. We count individual elephants by plane and get decent estimates of them, so we can monitor in that manner. Other ones are done by looking at range availability to a species. And so you know generally the type of habitat an animal relies on, and you can estimate how much of that habitat remains. And so we can use that as a proxy for its conservation status as well. So there's a number of species that are highly threatened by habitat loss. We may not know their actual numbers, but we know the area that they rely on to live is vanishing, and therefore they're vanishing.
That's something that we'll talk about later, about this kind of human-wildlife conflict that's happening in a lot of places. You wanted to say something, Rosemary?
No, I'm just listening to Dr. Wiedemeyer. Yeah.
So I just want to continue with you, George, because your last year's research, I mean, got a lot of attention, got widespread attention, especially these numbers that between 2010 and 2012, 100,000 elephants in Africa were killed for their ivory. So with all the attention that your report got, and there seems to be efforts in conservation of animals is getting more and more attention as well. What has changed in the past year? Because you seem to be a bit more hopeful from what I read about your work recently.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of global attention to this, as you mentioned, and it's at the highest level. Actually, this weekend, or maybe it was Friday, President Obama actually had direct dialogue with the president of China about the ivory issue. You know, of all the global issues that they're dealing with and they're discussing, one of them that came up was actually the ivory trade. Mm-hmm. And they both agreed that this is a problem that can be solved through actions to control domestic consumption of ivory in the United States and China. And so that level of dialogue on this issue gives me a lot of hope, actually. And we still have we're seeing that dialogue, but we're still seeing, large-scale killing continue. But the fact that it's been picked up at the highest levels of state governments of the key countries that are consuming ivory gives me a lot of faith. We also have, in our site where I work in northern Kenya, we were dealing with severe poaching several years ago. And we have an individually based monitoring project of elephants there. So we know every elephant individually, and we were recording their demise basically through poaching. And we've had experienced incredible success watching that turnaround really in the last couple years. And so, we're seeing this a few places across the continent. Recipes where it seems like we're seeing successes, we're slowing down the rate of killing, in some places pretty much stopping it. And so being able to identify the mechanisms whereby we can initiate success is the key to this story. And I think we've got a number of good models out there at this point.
Yeah, so we will talk about that. How do you measure success? Rosemary, you wanted to add something.
I want to join Dr. Wiedemeyer in being hopeful. I also want to append a note of caution to the agreements that are made between countries. The United States has taken many concrete steps, both at a federal level and at state levels. For example, California has AB 96, and New York and New Jersey have passed virtual bans on ivory and rhino horn trade. However, we'd like to see the state of China come up with a timeline for dismantling its domestic trade in ivory. And I think while we celebrate victories, and we all should and must, I think it's also important to keep applying civil and diplomatic pressure on China to come up with a timeline. I think that's critical.
Julie, what do you think?
I second what Rosemary said. The news came out that China and the United States had met and discussed this issue, and people are very hopeful, which is wonderful. But we do have to continue the pressure, and until there is a timeline and a concrete plan as to how these governments are going to go about stopping the poaching, it's just rhetoric at this point. It's hopeful rhetoric, but nonetheless, we need some concrete dates and methods as far as stopping the poaching.
And George, when we talked to you last year, you sort of compared the black market around the sales, illegal sales of ivory, to what has been happening to ISIS, that how they fund their terrorist activities through sales of oil. And it might be easy to stop them, but at the same time, not much is being done to stop them. So when it comes also to this black market of, what, $10 billion annually?
19. By some estimates, it's up to 19, but it's a variable number.
So how do you think you take this sort of complex web and unpack it, and how would you approach it? How would you approach to going about halting, really, this illegal and legal market?
Yeah, so the legal market has a number of issues in it, and I think Rosemary, and we can speak to this with some of the legislative action California has been putting through, and some of the other states have been putting through. Particularly, it's been very exciting to watch the domestic trade issues in the U.S. Focus on sort of the key consumptive nations of, I mean, states of New York, New Jersey, California, and Hawaii, and those states are actually trying to implement these bans. There's sort of a minor, what I would think of as a minority of individuals that are opposing this ban due to they feel like it'll block sales of certain commodities that they're interested in, that being basically weapons, guns that have ivory inlays or whatever on them, and interestingly enough, musicians who often use ivory as a material in their instruments. And so those are the two groups that oppose bans, but I think in general you're seeing widespread support of domestic bans in the U.S. And similarly, I think we're seeing a lot of civilian support for bans or action in China as well. And it's been interesting to watch the dialogue going on there about who's interested in trying to change the bans versus who's not. And it seems to me it's also a relative minority in China that's really has a vested interest in the success. Of course, the problem with that minority in China is they're probably relatively affluent and therefore potentially more powerful than sort of the average individual. But the fact that there's Chinese-led initiatives to stop ivory trade in China is really a positive development in my mind. And I think that's why we're seeing President Xi Jinping make statements to the fact that they will address the domestic ivory issue. So those are the things that I find hopeful. Certainly, the criminality involved in ivory trafficking and in general illegal wildlife trafficking. This is an issue. We often talk about elephants and rhinos and tigers, but this is an issue impacting numerous other species,
yes.
Not only wildlife, but rare plants and rare hardwood trees and fish and other things. And it's a as you mentioned, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. Those involved have vested interests in keeping it going. There's tons of criminality in it. And there are parallels to other areas we're seeing similar illegal trade going on. And we've had trouble disrupting those illegal trades. But there are skills and there are groups of individuals that have made inroads in disrupting some of that trade. And so we're hoping that to get some of those groups more involved. A lot of it is intelligence-based, and some of it is dealing with financial mechanisms to disrupt those groups. Not unlike some of the sanctions that we've seen have effect on other countries that are dealing with things the U.S. doesn't like. We put sanctions on them, and that can actually have huge impacts on those activities. And so there's a number of tools out there that we can use. They're not tools that we as conservationists can implement and do, but they're tools that our lobbying and our pressure on our government individuals can help catalyze to be implemented. And I think that's where these domestic actions and talking to your senators and talking to your representatives become so critical.
So talking about lobbying being important, one of the most important lobbies is the National Rifle Association. And they have been attacking the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services for its, promoting ivory ban and protecting elephants. So how crucial is the lobbying for and against? Can you talk about the NRA and their role in how they're trying to fight ivory ban, Rosemary?
Yeah. I tell you,
you can go ahead.
Go ahead,
and we'll go to Rosemary.
Go ahead, yeah, George. That's fine.
Everybody can throw their weight. it's a pretty interesting.
Yeah.
There's been quite a bit of comedians have enjoyed this one.
But, yes.
Sort of this everybody in the world is against killing elephants except the NRA.
Right.
And
I think it was John Stewart before he retired said if there's anything good happening anywhere, the NRA will be against it.
Right. Yeah. So it is pretty mind-boggling. And if you look at weapons trade, the amount of weapons that have ivory in it are an absolute minority compared to the domestic weapons trade in the U.S. But these issues, yeah, as you meant, they have a lot of political clout,
exactly.
These groups, and it's something that, can't be ignored and has to be dealt with. And ideally, we would have everybody on board, and we could just put this through with full support of everybody, across whatever political persuasion they have. But we're not really in that place. And I think the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has actually tried to work with the NRA to figure out ways that they could get the NRA to support legislation, like what sort of exemptions we could put in that would basically deal with this relatively minute part of the market, but allow this broader policy change to be put in place. And I think there's been some success to that. I can't speak as well to those details, but perhaps somebody else can.
Do you want to chime in, Rosemary?
Yes, I agree with George, and I agree also that it's a relative minority, but a powerful and moneyed lobby that influences, politics in the United States. With California, we've had relatively, low opposition. The NRA and its affiliates in California did show up at some of the public hearings in Sacramento. And AB 96, Assembly Bill 96, which has passed both houses, legislative houses in California, the Assembly and the Senate, and is awaiting the governor's signature, does have an exemption for items that have, I believe it's less than 20% in volume of...
For the musical instruments.
For musical instruments and for antiques as well, which are greater than 100 years old. So the interesting thing, though, is that in Hawaii, we've had worked with the Humane Society in Hawaii to get the bill passed for two consecutive years and failed. And it's unclear whether it's the local traders or the NRA that's influencing it. It's probably the former, but there are instances where powerful small lobbying groups can wield a great deal of influence on one or two individual representatives, and the representatives, if they happen to be heads of committees, of important and powerful committees, can table the bill. And by tabling it virtually indefinitely, you kill the bill. So, yeah.
And that's Rosemary Ollis, a member of the core organizing team for the Global March for Elephants and Rhinos. And we're also joined by Professor Wittemeyer, who's joined from, I think, from Denver, Colorado.
Yes.
And he is the scientific board chairman of Save the Elephants and assistant professor in the Department of Fish, Wildlife and Conservation, Biology at Colorado University. And we are also joined in studio by Julie Canahan. She is a March for Elephants spokesperson and co-founder of March for Elephants Santa Cruz. I'm sure a lot of people are interested in this topic. So we want you all to join us. And what do you think we should do about halting both legal and illegal ivory market? And have you been to a zoo? Have you ever asked where that elephant comes from? Have you ever made connections with them? They are extremely, extremely intelligent animals. And what do you think about what we can do more to protect these magnificent being? So, Rosemary, you were talking about the power of lobby, the power of lobby. What happened in California, do you think, that allowed that bill to go forward and land on
Governor Brown's desk? Yes. I think in California, we were really, really well prepared. We were watching the New York and New Jersey bills pass. New Jersey was relatively easy because it was the first on the table, and there's not a big market for ivory in New Jersey. New York is different. In California, we were prepared. We organized various groups on the ground. We collaborated, and I think that's really important to emphasize the criticality of collaborating with each other on these important bills and on these very difficult and, you know,
so there was a lot of activism in California.
There was a lot of it. We had thousands of people writing postcards to representatives. The Humane Society had a really wonderful lobbyist in Sacramento. Her name is Jennifer Fearing. She was open to people reaching out to her. And we communicated regularly. We had people, you know, traveling to the valley areas, to remote parts of California where we expected opposition to come from because they were more conservative areas. We set up tables at fairs, at street corners. We had people on bikes riding around distributing these postcards, and then we had them send them back to us and mail them into the senators, and personally visited the senators and legislative assembly members' offices and lobbied. So I think we were really, really well prepared and organized within our advocacy groups.
We'll talk more about that. Julie, we just have just 30 seconds before the break, and I wanted to ask you, as the co-founder of March for Elephant in Santa Cruz, what does this mean to you, what has happened in California, the bill that's going to be hopefully signed?
Well, I think it's an important statement. As a state, we're coming out, and as California is the second largest trader of ivory in the United States, and the United States is the second largest trader after China in the world.
So, sorry to cut you off. We have to go to break. That's Julie Callahan. We are also joined by Rosemary Ollis and Professor Wittemeyer. We'll be back.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear it from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the website yourcallradio.org. Thank you.
For those of you joining us now, I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll bring back a conversation we had with reporter Christina Rizgo about her new book, Mission High. Based on test scores, San Francisco's Mission High is a low-performing school, even though its graduation and college enrollment percentages are among some of the best in the country. So what does this reveal about education reform, and how can we really reform our education based on these local experiments? That's on Your Calls tomorrow. And today we are talking about what does it take to protect elephants and halt the rapid population decline of elephant, how difficult it is, what's being done both on activism and on the academic side, and what's in store for the future of this really magnificent and very, very emotional and very intelligent mammals. And what is the best way to stop the elephant poaching? We want to hear from you. If you have or like ivory, what do you think should be done to protect them? Why should we have ivory trinkets? Why should we have ivory chopsticks? What do you think we should do? And how do we have ivories every day? I mean, I have something, an ivory box that my brother brought from India many, many years ago, and I was just looking at it, and it was difficult to sort of give it up, but at the same time I was thinking of what can be done, you know, how we can change our behaviors and attitudes. You join the conversation today at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or better yet, leave a comment on our website at yourcallradio.org. And the phone number again, 866-798-8255. Sorry, I cut you off.
That's okay.
Before the break.
So something else, I can't remember exactly where I was. We were talking about you asked me why it's important. I was just reflecting just this morning before we came here. I saw an article that mentioned that last night, today, five rhinos, and rhinos are a part of this equation as well as the elephants. They're, as you mentioned in your opening statements, they're in a similar situation as the elephants. Mm-hmm. And five of them were found in South Africa, in the park in South Africa, KZN
KwaZulu-Natal
Park in South Africa. Five were poached, just believed to be just yesterday. And so these, you know, it's important that we're aware of this, and this is part of why we're involved in this, because these animals are dying at this alarming rate, and this is why we're marching this weekend as well.
So, George, I wanted to bring you in here. A couple of months ago, I think the killing of Cecil the lion grabbed a lot of attention, but we don't hear about that anymore. At least in the media, the hashtag about Cecil went crazy. I remember it was just trending for many, many weeks. Now it is the last week, the killing of another elephant, Yonki. It's a Sumeritan elephant that has put the spotlight on the ongoing global ivory market and the rapid decline in elephant populations. So as an academic, as a researcher who really tries to make this into a popular subject where people actually pay attention, ordinary people, do you think the spike of attention from social media and from the sort of a broader media, commercial and alternative, do you think it could also help bring about change? Not just attention, change. What do you think, George?
Yeah, certainly. I would say it has. I think, the March for Elephants group, so both Rosemary and Julie can speak to this with firsthand experience, but yeah, you know, the only hope we really have for many of these species and even a lot of wilderness areas is is deep interest and mobilization of impassioned individuals. And the reason we're seeing interest by, you know, President Obama himself and John Kerry and Hillary Clinton, they've all been very involved with this. I'm sure there's personal interest that's motivating it, but there's, you know, they're professional politicians, and a lot of it is that it's a issue of interest to the American people that they, I think, they see as being relatively apolitical. Obviously, we have the NRA issue that we already brought up, but broadly, you know, this is a issue supported by the American people, and so that allows it to be put on a high-level political agenda, which cascades into engagement, you know, direct engagement with China, as well as direct support for African nations who are dealing with the brunt of the problem here. You know, they're dealing with the supply mm-hmm. side issues and anti-poaching, and they're losing, you know, they're actually having rangers and individuals killed, families disrupted because of that, and countless social issues driven by this as well. And so Twitter or Facebook or whatever these social media campaigns are, they can have huge impacts, and I think they're becoming increasingly important in our society and in conservation more broadly.
Mm. We have an email from a listener, which is also relates to what we're talking about. It says, a few years back, there was a movement to urge the Vatican to stop using ivory for all religious statues. What is the stand of the Vatican on this? Rosemary, do any of you know about this?
I can address it, but I haven't been paying too much attention to that petition. I've been seeing it. When Laudato Si came out, the statement by Pope Francis, there was general celebration worldwide as to its nature. You know, I can't remember exactly how this was phrased on social media, but many of those who wouldn't normally pay attention to statements coming out by the Vatican or the Catholic Church were pleased and applauded that statement, which addressed environmental issues and the lives and times of sentient creatures. I do not think, and I'm not positive about this, that the Vatican has come out with a statement addressing the use of ivory in the Vatican gift shop. And I think it's an optimal time to pressure the Vatican to do so, and I think you would get a positive response from the Vatican as to this. That's how I can address that issue, and maybe others can chip in and, you know.
Yeah, we're going to go shortly to callers, but I wanted to ask you, Julie, do you think these campaigns, these social media campaigns and global campaigns in somewhere, which are basically internet-based, do you think they have long-lasting effects? Because we tend to see them and then they go away, and we don't know exactly what comes out of them until another elephant or rhino or a lion is killed. So what, as an activist, how do you see the consequences of ramifications of these efforts?
Social media.
And I think otherwise.
Social media is a very powerful tool. It's allowed us, I think it's been a huge success for AB 96 passing, for the movements that have taken place that have been effective. I think social media, we reach people globally, instantaneously. Mm-hmm. I'm not a huge social media fan myself, but on a personal level, but as an activist tool, it's incredibly powerful. And Twitter, Facebook, they're all very important for the work that we're doing. And I think long-lasting, it is very important. And we're doing beyond this march and beyond these individual campaigns, we're long-term trying to make some changes. And we wouldn't be nearly as successful without social media.
I want to pitch in to that statement and to support that statement by Julie to say that it has been incredibly powerful. We reach this year's march has more than now 130 cities marching. And if it weren't for social media, we wouldn't be there. Hmm. But there is, and I need to underline this, a difficult aspect also with social media. For example, there's a petition being passed around asking for Dan Ash, who's the director of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, to be fired simply, I don't want to use the word simply, but because he happens to be a hunter. And so while advocacy is a spectrum and all these different efforts coalesce, they confluence and come together to form one creative and if I may use the word beautiful whole, there's also a danger in advocacy that is not thoughtful and strategic. Dan Ash has been a friend to elephants. Mm-hmm. So I would say that our reach has been tremendous through social media, but it also has not been easy. It has been a process that requires lots of mediation and convincing people to come to the table in a thoughtful, intelligent, reasoned way that incorporates good science, thanks to Dr. Wiedemeyer and others, and reason and lobbying.
And that's the voice of Rosemary Alice, a member of the core organizing team for the Global March for Elephants and Rhinos. And we're also joined by Julie Callahan, and she is the March for Elephants, a spokesperson and co-founder of March for Elephants Santa Cruz. And also on the phone, we're joined by Professor George Wittemeyer. He's the scientific board chairman of Save the Elephants and assistant professor in the Department of Fish, Wildlife and Conservation Biology at Colorado University. And we also want to hear from you. What is the best way to stop elephant poaching? If you have, or like ivory, what do you think should be done to protect elephants and halt the trade, the global trade or local trade? And do you think they should be killed for their tusk? Do you think that is permissible? And if not, what can be done? So we want to hear from you. Join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or better yet, leave a comment on our website at yourcallradio.org, and you can get a conversation going on our website. Now let's go to a caller from Santa Cruz, Dr. Robert.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for this this wonderful program. It's long overdue. I remember some decades ago, maybe over 30 years, walking into a retail store at a major shopping center in San Diego, California, and it was a little store selling ivory. Mm. And I approached the Asian lady who was the owner, and presumably, and I just gave her my opinion about the use of ivory and so forth. Of course, she was rather indignant, and just couldn't understand why I would be dismayed. However, you don't see ivory retailers in any great numbers. And so I think that public opinion must be roused, and I think one of the ways to do it is to show the awful realities of the murders, of the wanton destruction of these innocent creatures. Most of them are sentient creatures, as you've said. So I think most senseless, mindless destruction of human beings and natural resources have to be brought to people's attention. People actually have to see some of the grisly details, and not just every once in a great while. Public sentiment, I think, has to be roused into action, and I think the role of technology, particularly the defense industry, data gathering industries of military institutions, drones come to mind, satellite images. If we can see people and things from thousands of miles up, we should be able to start tracking the poachers. And so I think there has to be a multi-pronged effort, but rousing public interest in large measures. The March for Elephants is just one way to do that. But the publicity has to be somewhat relentless, so that the trending, the faddishness, the glitz, the sensationalism, the controversy peaks and dies quickly, as has been mentioned already on the program.
Thank you so much. I wanted to pose this question. Thank you so much, Robert. I wanted to pose this question to all of you, actually. I just read that DNA for technology is being used to halt or actually trace some of the poachers. George, what do you think about the role that technology plays? For example, recently I read that DNA from elephant dung tusks reveal poaching hotspots, and scientists are trying to stop poachers by tracking seized ivories back to its source.
Yes, that was published recently, that work out of University of Washington.
Yes,
Dr.
Center
Wasser
for Conservation.
Yeah, as we mentioned, we're dealing often with species in pretty remote areas, relatively hard to observe them. On top of that, you have illegal killing. It's illegal. People do not want to be captured doing it. They don't leave much evidence of it. And then it's trafficked illegally as well. And so there's high levels of organization trying to cover all these different steps in the chain, so that we can't trace what's happening. And so the genetic tracing, there's also stable isotopic tracing of species, becomes really critical to sort of reconfigure where the commodity chain went, where the source population of that confiscated item, and in the case of elephants, ivory, came from. And that helps identify where we need to either try to remedy gaps in policing of the transit of goods, mm-hmm. or bolster on the ground operations for anti-poaching and protection. So those tools are really critical. One of the caller mentioned the use of drones. There's been application of drones is relatively sophisticated and relatively difficult. A lot of our application in the military context is surveillance-based, using intelligence information and putting the drone up to follow an individual or possibly patrolling a really recognized route where something might happen. And there's been some success with that for rhino poaching in Kruger National Park, mm-hmm. Where they have relatively limited access. It's a fenced park, so there's relatively limited access points for the poachers, and so they've used that to some effect. We have a radio tracking program where we're putting GPS collars on individuals, particularly individuals we presume are at risk, and we get real-time information on their location that we can use to deploy anti-poaching units in that area, and also we get information on erratic behavior by the individual that could be indicative of a problem. And we're using this both in an anti-poaching framework, but also in a framework which we mentioned briefly before, trying to deal with human-wildlife conflict. So elephants are a huge animal, and they eat a lot, and they love agricultural crops for obvious reasons, because they're rich, nutritionally rich. And so we use this. If an elephant enters a farm or an agricultural region, we can then get real-time information on it and flag local people or wildlife authorities in that area to tell them to respond to the elephant incursion. So there's a lot of technological advances out there that are really helping us make inroads on some of these problems, not just poaching and wildlife trafficking, but otherwise to other conservation issues too. And being adaptive and able to see opportunities is really critical for us to see success in these issues.
Rosemary, there's something that that goes beyond technology, and that's the realities on the ground in many of these places where there is rampant poverty, destitution, social and economic injustice. So how can we bring really together issues of conservation and economic justice as a way to have a very comprehensive and kind of try to look at this in a very fundamental and a structural way?
Yeah, It's a big question.
It is, and we have only a few minutes.
I know, and it has. I think it has a complex response. I see this happening increasingly on the ground in Africa with groups like, you know, Save the Elephants, Kenyans United Against Poaching, Big Life, and others. And particularly in South Africa, there's an interesting group that is collaborating with Elephants Alive. Dr. Michelle Henley, I think, heads out that group. But they work with a local group called the Black Mambas. And it's the first all-black, all-women anti-poaching group in the Limpopo region. And they've had some pretty decent success. They recently won, I believe, a UN Earth Prize and were recognized for their work. And I think, and I fully support and applaud the efforts, all efforts that, are found in that intersection between science and technology. I come from a science background myself. I'm not a scientist, but a software engineer. And I think the drone efforts, the social media efforts, the technology efforts are all important. But I do believe at the heart of this matter is are humans who live on the ground, abutting these increasingly fragmented areas that are inhabited by the sentient giants. And I think engaging people on the ground is critical. One story, and very quickly, if I may, that came from Uganda, is with a young man by the name of Arinaitwe Moses, who's desperately trying to gather resources in the region he lives in order to advocate, to march, to establish bee fences. And repeatedly we hear the stories of people who can't afford $200, $300 to get a group of people together to do some work. And this is pervasive. It's a pervasive problem, and obviously the large NGOs can't solve these problems, but it's encouraging to see that there's increasing movement in that direction. I believe, and this is perhaps maybe viewed as rather a controversial statement, but the NGOs in Africa and in the countries that I come from, in Sri Lanka, they are modeled on a colonial from a colonial paradigm, and they're headed out mostly by Westerners. Mm-hmm. And that is seen with increasing resentment by the local people. And that has to change. These models need to change to engage local people, be headed out by the indigenous peoples of the land, and their input needs to be an integral component of the equation that leads to anti-poaching efforts.
And I wanted to put that question to you, Julie, as an activist, mm-hmm. an advocate. It's really important, as she said, about this colonial relationship between the West and the South. How do you approach this when you're talking about those far lands with so many different problems, economic, social, corrupt regime, many of them militarized, supported by the United States. So how do you use this as a platform to really create a way for people to understand why this is happening and not just to sign a petition and try to save an elephant? Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to point out to people the large picture, the fact that organized crime is involved in this issue and how they use the money that they make from the sales of the ivory to purchase guns and then destabilize the African continent. And the United States is culpable in this, in selling many of the weapons that go to these organizations. And so I think it's important to tie all of this in, as well as to talk about the organizations that Rosemary mentioned, such as the Black Mambas and the Kenyans United Against mm-hmm. Poaching, and let them know that these people are working very hard, 24/7. They're dedicating their lives to saving these animals, and we need to support them from the United States the best that we can, which is by lobbying our government and speaking out to other governments and asking them, urging them to take a stronger stand against wildlife trafficking.
And George, as an academic, as someone who's working on conservation issues, how do you bring social and economic justice issues and also realities on the ground in those countries and make it a part of not only your research but also solutions that you propose as a scientist?
So You know, we're dealing with a lot of these areas that we're working at. The area I work in particularly is a very rural area in Kenya. It's very impoverished. It's a pastoralist community, so they're reliant on livestock and they're relatively nomadic in moving through the landscape. And it's a difficult area. It's relatively volatile politically, and so it's a difficult area to invest in, I guess, for other economic development opportunities in that region, and so it's largely left to itself by the nation and by the government because of difficulties in administering it, basically. And in those contexts, it turns out that while livestock is a primary economic driver in the region, the second biggest revenue generator is wildlife conservation, and wildlife conservation. It turns out it can create revenue in areas that are pretty intractable in many other ways, and it can be a real impetus for development and for opportunities, education opportunities, and in general alleviating some of those issues. That being said, conservation across Africa and a lot of places is increasingly taking on more development roles. And there's quite a debate academically about if this is correct. Should conservation, which classically has been focused on the wildlife and the wild spaces, should it be equally invested in the development of the rural poor?
I hate to cut you off. I think we're running out of time. And I just want you, Rosemary, to talk about this weekend's events quickly, please.
Okay. So,
and we have all this information on our website, yourcallradio.org.
Yeah.
Everything, yeah.
The Global March has 130 cities marching. You can find it on our website, marchforelephants.org. In San Francisco, we are marching starting at Jefferson Square Park. There'll be peaceful and civil theater at the Chinese consulate asking for a timeline. We demand a timeline. And we start at 10 a.m. Please come join us and check the website out and find a city close to you. And go march and civilly, peacefully, and passionately on behalf of these wonderful animals that we do not want to lose.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Julie Callahan, Rosemary Ellis, and Professor George Wittermeyer. Always a pleasure to have you on. And thank you for your emails and phone calls. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And here is what's coming up tomorrow. What are the best solutions for improving public education? On the next Your Call, we'll bring back a conversation we had with reporter Christina Rizga about her new book, Mission High. Based on test scores, San Francisco's Mission High is a low-performing school, even though its graduation and college enrollment percentages are some of the best in the country. What does this reveal about education reform? Join us on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.